This episode is brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. Made with a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. To learn more, visit rt11.com. This week on a special bonus episode of Meat in 3, we find out why the bacon, egg, and cheese, that classic bodega sandwich, is popping up on menus of New York's trendiest restaurants.
We did a few iterations of it, and I was trying to fancify it. We tried the sausage, egg, and cheese, and then we tried to put shamula sauce on it. We used feta cheese, and we just like taking ingredients of the Mediterranean, if you will, and try to infuse it. But for me, it was like a car wreck.
Tune in to hear about the wild journey of the bacon, egg, and cheese, from deli to fine dining, on Meat in 3, HRN's weekly food news roundup, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, and welcome to the food scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel. On today's episode, how did a character on the American political drama The West Wing inspire a cinematically shot cooking show? Well, whatever the circumstance, Andrew Ray's Binging with Babish YouTube channel has become a marvel with over 5 million subscribers. Ray's recipes are recreations or creations of admiration for some of the greatest moving pictures and TV shows and movies that have food displayed in it. To that effect, he's now made a Binging with Babish cookbook, cataloging some of the movies and television's greatest culinary scenes, from Big Night's Timpano, the Confit Bialdi from Ratatouille, Prison Gravy from Goodfellas, Buddy's Pasta from Elf, and of course, fried green tomatoes, which I think satisfies all those things. Well, first of all, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And it was so funny. First of all, I've been mispronouncing your show for a while, thinking it's Binging with Babish, and I couldn't understand why.
Dude, I've heard everything from, you know, people have said Babish and binging. I heard once. I was like, where'd you get that from?
But when I mentioned to someone who I think is a YouTube aficionado that Andrew Ray was going to be on the show, they said, who? I said, oh, the Babish guy. Everyone knows you as this Babish character.
Yeah.
Who is Babish?
He was, as you mentioned, an ancillary character from The West Wing. And I get a chuckle every now and then, hoping that one day Aaron Sorkin will have heard about my show and he'll be like, what the fuck? Like, is that character that I wrote into 8 episodes of The West Wing, like, that's a whole YouTube series now? I hope that he finds out the strange new life that his character's name has been given.
Have you ever tried to reach out to Oliver Platt, who played that character, to be on the show?
He is aware of the show because he's buds with Jon Favreau, who wrote the foreword for my book.
And his brother's Adam Platt of New York Magazine, the food critic.
I did not know that.
So there is that relation.
Is that why he played a food critic and chef? Because
quite possibly, yeah. It's in his blood.
That's fitting.
So hopefully someday the synergy, everything comes back together.
No, that would be a nice full circle event.
But I feel like the circle started in the most odd way. This series was an odd passion of yours in 2006.
Yep.
And it wasn't until 2014 where you recreated Friends Moist Maker that this thing exploded.
Do you mean 2016? Because 2006,
yes.
I don't think YouTube existed in 2006. So I started in 2016. I just made it as a side project, and yes, the Moist Maker was the first one to sort of get some real attention. It was all thanks to Reddit. It just climbed the ranks on Reddit videos. It didn't even hit number one, but it was enough to get it featured on Entertainment Weekly and Food and Wine, and just give me a little bit of, you know, momentum. And I just kept making it. And within a few months after that, I think within 6 months after that, I quit my job and made it my full-time job.
Let's talk about your job before Binging with Babish, or let's talk about your life before becoming this voice and this torso that everybody seems to know. Born and raised near Rochester, New York.
Yep.
What is the culinary scene there like, and what do you remember growing up cooking and eating? You're Polish, Italian, Welsh descent. I mean, it seems all so muddied.
Yeah, my mother was mostly Italian, so there was a lot of Italian food flying around the house. Her linguine with white clam sauce is still fresh on my palate. She taught me to cook when I was very young. She passed away when I was 11, and it was just a nice way to sort of remember and feel closer to her cooking. As far as the culinary scene in Rochester, I think about the things that we can lay claim to are the garbage plate, which I champion all day. It's basically, for the uninitiated, it is a plate with French fries and mac salad topped with either two cheeseburgers or two hot dogs, topped with this, it's called a meat sauce, it's called hot sauce, and it's really just an onion and beef sauce that's spiced, oddly spiced with like cinnamon and allspice. It's very strange, but it is a Rochesterian specialty, and I do adore it. And what else do we have there? We have Zweigel's hot dogs, and Wegmans, of course, is the greatest grocery store in the known universe.
Which is now opening in Brooklyn.
It's now in Brooklyn. I think they're opening in a few days. I'm going to miss it because I'm going to be on this book tour, which I'm actually genuinely sad about.
Yeah.
if you've ever met anybody who has been to or grew up around Wegmans, they talk about it religiously. Nobody talks about a grocery store that way.
Yeah.
So it's clearly something to cut above. It's different than your Whole Foods or your whatever.
But did you obsess with the garbage plate and those hot dogs and these foods of your youth? How did food resonate throughout your life? I mean, how did it culminate into doing a pseudo cooking show? More pseudo, like an actualized cooking show.
I always thought I was a halfway decent chef. I wasn't. I was a very bad chef. I thought it was hot shit. But I was, you know, as I mentioned in the introduction of the book, I was whipping up raw chicken breast stuffed with like cream cheese and artichoke hearts and
English muffins.
Oh God, these raw English muffins. That was in college. That was like too late to be doing that. So I always thought I was great at it. But then again, like I say in the introduction for the book, there was a fateful hangover breakfast that I promised my friends after a night of debauchery. And they came out of the bedroom all hungover and messed up, and they were met with me making sous vide quail egg shaved asparagus and black truffle crostini, which they managed to eat one or two of before being like, is there a diner nearby? And that's when I realized, okay, I'm going to start being the kind of cook that people like. In other words, somebody who makes food they actually want to eat, not trying to impress them with a concept, but just making like genuinely good food, getting a hold of the basics. So that was like a big turning point that took place in, I don't know, 2011, 2010. I basically hit this massive creative slump. I was, I had just finished working on a project that took the life out of me, and it was creatively unfulfilling, and it was emotionally taxing. It was a very bad relationship with these people that I was working with, and it sent me into this deep spiral of a depression. And I eventually thought, okay, I need to start helping myself. So I went and sought the therapy that I needed, and realized that I needed to find a new creative outlet. So I bought a camera and a light to try to do some freelance documentary work. Set it up in the kitchen, and there was an episode of Parks and Rec on in the background where Ron and Chris were having a burger cook-off, and I was like, what would that actually taste like, Chris's crazy, trendy, you know, healthy burger? And I said, yeah, maybe I should do that on camera, and there we go. That's how it began.
And it was the Traeger turkey burger with a Taleggio cheese crisp, papaya chutney, black truffle, aioli, microgreens on a gluten-free brioche bun.
Yeah.
And you know, that sounds like what you tried to serve your drunk friends the day after versus what?
Ron's burger, which is just a burger. Just give me a good burger, you know?
It's just beef on a bun.
Exactly.
So when did you realize that even in recreating food, the best foods were the most basic ones?
I guess a big turning point with that was probably Pasta Aglio Olio, which was, I think, episode number 3, I think. It was in the movie Chef. Jon Favreau is preparing it for Scarlett Johansson. Scarlett Johansson. That would have been a totally different kind of scene. Preparing it for Scarlett Johansson, and she's just like eye fucking him because he's making this beautiful pasta. And I tried making it, and it was It was really exciting to see 7 ingredients, 8 if you include boiling water, come together to make something greater than some of their parts. It's very empowering as a new cook to see that, you know, you can take these simple ingredients and make something transcendent out of them. And that's why it's a very important dish to me. It's why I have a tattoo of it, because so many people tagged me on Instagram saying I tried cooking for the first time because this seemed so simple and holy shit, was it good. And so that's been a very important dish. Also because it eventually introduced me to Jon Favreau, who wrote the foreword for my book. But that's the one that did it, was Pasta Aglio Olio.
I also think it's the idea of being able to replicate something rather than create something out of the blue, because your sous vide quail eggs was in your mind's eye, but it wasn't something as prophetic that has lasted the test of time like that pasta.
Yeah.
So in trying to cook these things, do you look to replicate or do you look to iterate?
Depends. In the case of Pasta Aglio Olio, I'm definitely trying to replicate because that stuff looked good, and the Scarlett Johansson lets out when she eats it lets you know that's really, really good. In that case, I'm just trying to replicate the feeling, the sensation, the idea of what's happening on screen. In other cases, definitely trying to iterate. In the case of, say, Charlie's Milk Steak from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
Yeah, we'll talk about
okay,
that.
Sorry,
I have it as my notes because the sound that I forget his. They're doing a dating scene, right? They're trying to do this dating profile for Charlie, and they say, "What is your favorite food?" And when he says milk steak, the sound that one of the characters makes.
I think Dennis goes,
"Yeah, that stop and." You hear something like that, and what in the world could milk steak be?
I heard a hilarious theory, because to me it was just, he would say milk steak boiled over hard, so I assumed that meant a steak boiled in milk until it's hard, I don't know. And so that's what I assumed. Some genius commenter said, I think Charlie thought that cheese was milk steak. I was like, that's brilliant.
Yeah.
Because he would totally think that, so I might have gotten that wrong, but... in that case, I'm trying to iterate because it was disgusting. So I want to, I make it faithfully to the source material, and then I try to make my own version of it to the best of my ability, which in that case was particularly exaggerated because I wanted to go so far in the opposite direction and make it very chefy and plated and composed, if you will.
It had these beautiful Parmesan polenta cubes and rosemary pea shoot gel. I thought it was stunning. The food in there, It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, is very two-word, like rum ham as well. When we're getting more and more complex, say something that isn't, you know, as akin to what you ate growing up or what you've cooked before, like Tampopo's ramen. Mm-hmm. How do you start trying to figure out a recipe, both from a cooking standpoint, but also from a visual one?
I mean, that was a mountain to climb. Ramen from Tampopo, especially because he's there with a ramen master, like this guy who's literally dedicated his life to mastering the idea of. And it's the art of eating ramen. I don't even know if he makes it. I think he just eats it. And him just sort of breaking down, like, you know, the way the pork looks and the way that the fat glimmers on the surface of the stock and the way the noodles are tucked in a corner and just all this stuff. So I knew I had to recreate it very accurately in terms of what we saw in that scene. But also, you know, I did some research in terms of where did that movie take place. So what kinds of ramen might that have been with those ingredients, with a fish cake and with a, with pork belly that isn't, hasn't been rolled. It's just been cut. The broth is very light and light brown. It's not deep. It's not cloudy. That pointed to a kind of a specific kind of ramen. And then it was a matter of just scouring the internet, trying to find the best way to do that, that wouldn't piss off too many people, that would hopefully make them, you know, think that I did a halfway decent job, because I have no grasp of any of that stuff. I mean, I love ramen, obviously, just like everybody else in New York City, but I don't have like a deep understanding of it the way that, you know, the way that I should to recreate something like that from a movie that's so dedicated to food. Just a matter of doing my research. That's really what it comes down to.
When I started watching your show, I'm sure everyone does this too. They try to think of their favorite food scenes of movies and television. Mine's actually from Tampopo, but it is not the ramen.
Which one is it?
It's the omur rice that they make. That omelet that folds open, and it's the homeless chef that comes in and teaches the kid how to make this soft omelet that opens up on top of rice like a flower. And it's taken me years to even get close to saying I've done it well. Not mastered, but just done it well.
That is supposed to be, I've never tried it personally, that is supposed to be a dastardly difficult dish to master. So good on you for trying so much.
Well, that's what I kind of love about your videos is that you don't always cook things that well the first time, and there are mistakes. So why did you intentionally leave those edits in your videos?
I mean, that's an mark of cooking shows of old is to have everything made perfectly in a perfect kitchen by a perfect person with their perfect family and their perfect dog. And it's actually discouraging as a cook to watch older cooking shows. Not Julia, because she would show her mistakes. Julia Child would show when she would screw up, and it would be great. I wanted to make the antithesis of the common cooking show, which is, you know, everything just happening perfectly in this perfect world. I wanted to show my mistakes because to the home cook, that's way more encouraging. Like, it humanizes you as a personality on screen. Like, I make mistakes too. I'm just a home cook. I'm just figuring it out with you guys. And I think it's more encouraging if you're somebody who's never been in the kitchen or has very limited time in the kitchen, to know that it's okay to make mistakes, and it's okay. They're learning opportunities. This is an opportunity to see what you did wrong, and you can do it better next time, especially when you're serving it to somebody. You know, you might make it better than you would have otherwise.
You cover this recipe in your book, and I love the plating of this so much because, I'll explain in a second, just because it sets the scene so well, but Kevin's famous chili from The Office.
Yeah.
And the first time I ever saw it, laughed my butt off. The second time, the video stopped working and all I heard was the overvoice, which actually talks through the recipe in the most succinct and beautiful way. And mm-hmm. if you didn't know what happened in that video, you thought it was going to, you think of it as a perfect reiterated recipe.
Yeah.
You also choose to do overvoice rather than talk in real time. Why that concept?
To be honest, I make the show mostly myself still. I definitely get help with basics because it's a multi-camera show and it's a little bit more difficult to edit. I definitely get help with because it's a travel vlog kind of thing. But binging, I still make front to back myself. I'm hitting record on the cameras, I'm pulling focus, and I'm editing it. And the real answer is that because when I started off, this was just a hobby. It wasn't something that I was trying to make into a career or anything like that. So I wanted to make it as easy as possible. And the easiest way to make this kind of cooking show is to edit it together, get all the steps in place, and then just talk about what you're doing after the fact. It's way easier not only to do, you know, to physically cook, then I can just focus on cooking. I don't have to talk and cook. But then after the fact, I can just, you know, narrate what I'm doing. And it's much easier. And it turns out that it doesn't bother people. So, you know, it's become my form factor.
So, and the best way to serve Kevin's famous chili is on a swath of carpet. On that
the
note,
only way. Yeah.
The only way. Yeah. On that, we're going to take a quick break and come right back and talk more with Andrew Ray of Binging with Babish. Cheers.
Cool.
This episode is brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. From the moment Route 11 dropped their first batch of chips back in the early days of 1992, they understood their destiny as a high-quality producer. Instead of succumbing to the frenzy of mass production, they took advantage of their small size and made chipping a personal art form. The payoff was immediate, an incredible potato chip. With a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. In this world of uncertainty that we live in, Route 11 Potato Chips believe comfort food can be just that. Know where your food comes from. To learn more, visit rt11.com.
Join Heritage Radio Network on Monday, November 11th, for a raucous feast to toast a decade of food radio. Our 10th anniversary Bacchanal is a rare gathering of your favorite chefs, mixologists, storytellers, thought leaders, and culinary masterminds. We'll salute the inductees of the newly minted HRN Hall of Fame, who embody our mission to further equity, sustainability, and deliciousness. Join us to explore the beautiful Palm House and Yellow Magnolia Cafe at the Brooklyn Botanic Garden, where you'll taste and imbibe to your heart's content, and bid on once-in-a-lifetime experiences and tasty gifts for any budget at our silent auction. Join the party. Tickets are available now at heritageradionetwork.org/gala.
And welcome back to the Food Scene on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan-Turkel, here today with Andrew Ray of Binging with Babish. And there are so many wonderfully cinematic food scenes and televisions and movies. But I feel like when you say that, the conversation starter is often one of two things: the timpano from Big Night or the confit bialdi from Ratatouille. It is not Ratatouille. It is confit bialdi.
Which is just a dressed up ratatouille. It's a just a reimagined chefy. I think Thomas Keller designed that dish. I can't remember, but don't hold me to that. But those are two movies that really love and care about food. Them and Chef, but Big Night in particular is a movie about the powerful nature of food.
I mean, aside from the girth and size of a timpano, how intimidating are those two recipes? Not only that people have seen these movies and know these foods well, but the complexity of both of them is pretty intense.
I mean, ratatouille is not, I mean, it's definitely a little intense, not nearly as bad as timpano. Timpano is just a huge amount of work for what I would call not that big a payoff. Like, I know that they were eating it and rolling their eyes like, this is so good, in the movie. But, I mean, they really could have accomplished the same thing with some lasagna. It's really a giant lasagna with some eggs in it, which is whatever. So their sauce and their pasta must have been really good. They didn't need to put it in this giant thing.
There's that instant in Big Night where they all start eating the timpano and the one guest smacks his hand on the table and says, "God damn it." And you think he's pissed because he got served this peasant dish. But he walks up to the chef and says, "I could kill you because this is so good."
Yeah.
So it wasn't. It wasn't that good.
I mean, I'm sure it was very good. It's just it's not going to taste any better because you made this big timpani drum out of it for the layered, gigantic lasagna with eggs. It's perfectly good, but you could achieve the same culinary catharsis with lasagna. I don't think you need to put all that work into it just to make it. That's really just for presentation's sake.
It's the flip. It's like making Todd egg, the crispy rice and potato dish. It's presentation.
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot more food I want to cover in that movie. There's so much good stuff in there.
Confit bialdi from Ratatouille. We've all seen the using the razor blade to cut garlic for prison gravy in Goodfellas.
Yeah.
Those all sound delicious. What have been some of the more disgusting dishes you've made?
Well, this is what you're talking about with Charlie's milk steak. Charlie's milk steak takes the cake. it was repugnant. It was a steak boiled in milk with I couldn't get a bite down. It was horrible. Let's see. Buddy's pasta from Elf, which I ironically have probably had to eat more than most any other dish on the show because the first time I shot it, cameras weren't rolling. Perils of making things yourself, I guess, is I forgot to hit record on the cameras, or the cards were full, rather. So then I had to make it again, and then I got invited to go on BuzzFeed and make it there, so I had to eat it three times in as many days.
The SNL Taco Town Taco, you actually recreated this?
Wasn't that bad. It was. I should make a good version of that. That's something I wanted to do and go back and do, because it is a 15-layer taco. It's I can't remember all the layers, but it starts off with
crepes and blueberry pancakes.
Yeah, it starts off with tacos and burritos and stuff, and then it starts turning French and American and all different kinds of stuff towards the outside, and then the whole thing's battered and deep fried, which was perilous. That was terrifying to deep fry something that big. It was very hard to find a pot large enough to hold it, and then I have these huge rubber gloves on, and I'm terrified that I'm about to melt my skin off. But it worked out.
Are you terrified that you've now crossed over into this culinary scene? And do you consider yourself a cook? Do you consider yourself a chef?
No, I consider myself a home cook. Definitely not a chef. I have not worked. I've worked in a restaurant making crepes back when I was in high school,
perfect for the Taco Town Taco.
Exactly. Yeah. I nailed the crepes. and And I what else did I do? I worked at the Chocolate Room over in Park Slope. It was my first hourly job when I moved to the city, but I was serving I was plating. So that's the extent of my restaurant experience. So I do not get to call myself a chef, especially because at best I'm coming up with creative interpretations of the foods they see on screen. I'm not being terribly inventive and innovating in the space like you might want to do as a chef. So,
but there must have been something empowering about seeing Jon Favreau transform himself into someone who is more than just a cook, not only in that movie but now in real life.
Oh yeah,
has that been your, you know, has that been the canon of who you want to be?
Absolutely. And as to keep bringing up references to movies here in Ratatouille, you've got Chef Gusteau who says anyone can cook. And that's what I am. I am a cook. And I can cook pretty decently some things.
I watched an episode of you with Iron Chef Masahiro Morimoto.
That was nuts.
And you were recreating the regular show's death sandwich. And yeah. I love that episode.
Thank you.
And it was almost truly a death sandwich because he added some blowfish to it.
Yes. Poisonous puffer fish. If butchered or not butchered, if cleaned incorrectly is fatal with no antidote. We got it. I guess he bought it from Japan. It was cleaned in Japan by licensed technicians, and it was like $300 for a fish. And then we ended up putting it all on a on a sandwich. And I don't think he knew what he was getting into.
Yeah.
So he was like, "What is this?" And he was a sport. He rolled with it, which was great.
But you've been introducing other people to the show. There was a great episode with Maisie Williams of Game of Thrones, and you recreated the direwolf bread.
Yeah, and that was another wild experience because I woke up in the morning and saw on Twitter, you've received a message from Maisie Williams. And I was like, bullshit. And I put it back down and go back to sleep. I sleep in. And then I wake up and I'm like, wait a minute. And I look at it and it's her. And I'm like, oh my God. And she says, you know, I'm in town for Fashion Week. Are you shooting? I love the show. And I was like, I can be. I will be now. Yes. And I feel bad because I eventually made a good tasting version of direwolf bread, but initially my goal was to make something that looked exactly like the one from the show, which, you know, really I'm making prop food at that point. So it was this very oddy, a lot of roughage in this bread, but it looked exactly right. But it was very difficult to eat. So I feel bad that I didn't get to feed her anything good, but she was really cool to come by and do a little direwolf bake-off with me.
You're obviously watching TV and movies all the time for the next culinary scene. I mean, have you coaxed any shows or hoped any certain films that you've seen have that epic food scene that you can then recreate?
I'm always on the lookout. One disadvantage is that I really love to show the clip from the movie, and I can't, if it's in theaters and some new hot food scene comes out and it's in theaters, then I can't do anything until it comes out on video. I would love to work with movie theaters. Or I've had a couple screenwriters. The screenwriter of Dallas tweeted at me, and he was like, let's get some food in season whatever so Benjamin Babish can recreate it. I was like, yes, dude. Let's create a cottage industry here.
Yeah.
But no, I'm my ear's always to the ground. I'm always trying to find what's next. But I can never anticipate it. I've never been like, oh, that should be X, Y, or Z. I'm always surprised by what I find and by what I'm able to pay tribute to.
And you did the full circle. You cooked something from the West Wing.
Yes. I made tomate du saltimbique, which we never see. We only hear it described in detail by President Bartlett 2020, our best president. He describes in detail this dessert tomato. It is a tomato stewed in creme de caramel, which is not a thing, and filled with passion fruit and nuts and all kinds of stuff. And it's a dessert tomato, and I tried making it exactly as he described it, and it was too long. They said stewed for like an hour and a half in creme de caramel, and I was like, the tomato fell apart. It was no good, and the fruits weren't quite right. So I found another very obscure recipe for this dish, and tried that version and put my own little tweaks on it, and actually ended up being quite good. You can make a tomato for dessert.
In going through, I mean, there's over 150 episodes at this time, mm-hmm. and you have no plans of stopping, but you've also started two other series. One is all about basics, and one is about health, and I admire that through this journey, you had a realization about what this journey was doing to you.
Yeah.
And you're hoping to not only just have people cook, you know, the diabetes pasta, such as, you know, Buddy's saccharine sweet.
Yeah,
you care inherently about food now in a way that you never had before.
Yeah, being is, it's also my opportunity to sort of give back to people who either need it or deserve it. I've been given so much by my audience, just by them tuning in, watching and sharing and whatever. They've given me this beautiful, amazing dream career and this dream life that I'm living right now. And being is my opportunity to try and say thank you in whatever ways I can. So I did have the one episode about me trying to lose some weight, but also I've done ones where we went to Florida to find this super fan who he had sent me a sample of Szechuan sauce. You remember Szechuan sauce when it set the internet on fire?
I mean, I don't remember the initial origins of it, but I am a Rick and Morty fanatic.
Exactly. Yes. So they made mention of it. I recreated it, and then McDonald's did a little giveaway. Before they did the wide release, they did a giveaway. They gave away three bottles of sauce, and one guy who got it sent me a sample because he actually won it. And then I found out 2 years later he had fallen on hard times. So we flew down to Florida, and I gave him a new Vespa and a new laptop and an annual pass to Disney because he's a Disney fanatic. And we were able to just sort of give back in a way to somebody who had very directly helped the growth of the show. So that felt really nice to do. So that's what we're trying to do with all these episodes.
It's very unlike the situation between Larry David and Ted Danson in the sandwich scene.
Quite unlike that, yes. That one's all about just trying to have the better sandwich,
yeah.
Which, you know, I would prefer the better sandwich if I were in Larry's position.
I mean, one quick question about sandwiches. The Teamster sandwich from 30 Rock.
Yes.
Do you know who makes and serves that Teamster sandwich? I have an idea.
Fiore's in Jersey, I believe, is where the writer from... Basically, I read an article saying that the writer of 30 Rock was using Fiore's as a inspiration.
Yeah. I mean, some of this food exists in the real world.
Yeah, which is great.
And have you ever been to any of these places to taste them in person?
In that case, I went to Fiore's and I got the bread and I got the roast beef and I got all the elements of the sandwich, put them together at home so it would be fresh and hot, and then tried to reverse engineer it, essentially. As many times as I've been able to, I've tried to taste the real thing. The other example that comes to mind is fish tacos from I Love You Man, which is from James Beach Tacos in Venice Beach, and they were really good.
See, I can't wait till this becomes super meta and they make a movie about you in the vein of Julia and Julia, and then someone starts cooking from the Binging with Babish, you know, show on YouTube, and it's that secondary, it's that tertiary, it's going to be another circle complete.
I hope so, yeah.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for doing what you do, and I'm going to dig deep and send you some of the weirdest food scenes I've ever seen, and hope that you create, like Peter Greenaway, Cook, Wife, Thief, Lover. I mean, the spread that they have on that table, it's just mind-blowing, mind-boggling.
Yeah.
But I'm going to start sending you stuff.
Please
Babette's
do.
Feast.
Oh, I mean, I've done one thing from
that.
I did Cayenne Sacrifice from Babette's Feast. And another one that comes to mind is the beginning of, and I'm sorry, I know we're running out of time, the beginning of Eat, Drink, Man, Woman.
Yes.
That cooking scene is superlative. But I can't cook like that. Like, that guy's been doing it his entire life, clearly. But thank you so much for having me,
Excellent.
Man.
Again, thank you. You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel. Hoping to have you back here next Tuesday at 3. A big thank you to Route 11 Potato Chips, Music by Cookies, and Matt Patterson Engineering. Cheers. The Food Scene is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org, or connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage, and thanks for listening.